The Game Schooler Podcast is a weekly audio show that educates new and experienced gamers about the awesomeness of tabletop gaming. In this week's episode, we'll cover Tokaido and Nemiji, our games of the week, discuss logic and self-control for younger gamers in the school of gaming, and wrap it up by revealing our high five, the original is better games. Welcome to the Game Schooler Podcast. I'm your host, Doug Kotecki, along with my co-host, Dr. Michael McCabe. How's it going, Michael?
What's going on, Doug? How are you?
Oh, I can't complain. You know, we've got the basic things going on, root canals, dogs with gum in their fur, everything you expect on a Tuesday.
Yeah, sorry to hear that, Doug, but sounds like you're making progress on all your life projects that life throws at you, right?
Yeah. How about you? What's new with you?
Man, everything's good. Really just been, life is good. I can't complain. So blessed and things are great. And I've also, from a board game wise, gotten a chance to play a lot of different games lately.
All right. Is that follow-up or is that what's awesome?
Well, I actually have some follow-up. And it's because we're all about the hotness here at the Game Schooler Podcast, right?
Yeah, about out-of-print games and...
Yeah, I have some Gen Con follow-up from 2023. And if you recall our coverage from Gen Con, there were two games that I held off on. One, because of being cheap and not wanting to pay $50 to Capstone for Wandering Towers, right? Can't go home with... That would have been like game 31 taking home in the hall, and I couldn't justify it. And then two was Three Ring Circus... I had some questions about the colors, and both of those were quote unquote darlings of the con, you know, games that people were then flipping after the convention for 300%. And, you know, you see stuff like that.
Yeah.
Well, unbeknownst to me, I just happened to pick up both in a trade, in multiple trades.
Unbeknownst to you?
To me. No, okay. Correction. I actively sought out the trade, but all that to say, you know, 2-3 years ago, I would have been that guy right after the convention looking to pay $70, $80, $90 to get those games. Got to get them now. And now, you know, 8 months after the convention, we're within about 120 days of the next Gen Con. People are getting rid of their copies that they picked up. And so it's just nice to be on the other end of the cycle. And one of the games I got played, Three Ring Circus, just a fantastic little game, a lot in that box where I only played the solo version, but it was nice. Set it up on a Saturday, learned the rules on a Saturday, played it, and I was like, is that it? I played the whole game in 45 minutes.
Yeah.
So cool little game where you're trying to get circuses set up in small towns and then go to medium cities to go to large cities. And you're always trying to just be prepared for Barnum, right? Because your Barnum is racing around each time you make a performance that moves the Barnum tracker, and that's kind of a way that it's a timer essentially for the game. So cool little game, had a lot of fun, but I did want to share that with our listeners because those were two games that, you know, is all hyped about coming out of the convention, and here we are, just wait 8 months, get the rest of the games played, and they're here. They're in the house and
now,
getting played.
Did your enjoyment go down from not having them immediately?
No. In fact, no. I'll just answer that succinctly.
You enjoyed it more knowing that you spent less money on it. I'm interested in Three Ring Circus. I have kicked the tires on that many, many of times. So
cool.
I'm anxious to destroy you in that one.
Yes. Yes, bring it, Doug.
We had Board Game Club again this week, which went well, and getting new and more kids to the table, which is awesome. I do love seeing the excitement of, oh, you brought this game. Oh, this game. I remember this one, you know, and kids grabbing games and you know, teaching them to fellow people and fellow kids and even – some students teaching their teacher how to play a game. So pretty cool to see and glad to be a part of that.
Well, and different educators walking through the library, right?
Yeah.
Last week there was a different teacher. This week I think it was a math teacher that just stopped and played some Dinosaur Tea Party. The librarian has actually gone ahead and ordered a chunk of games for the library and for the community. And it's one of those things that we heard about this from a retailer at an event a couple of years ago who was giving away games. And there is to his local school, and there is something to the wonder and awe of gaming. You know, this opening segment where we talk about what's awesome with gaming, it is awesome to really see that. And people are happy. Typically, you know, people are happy when others are happy. And so that has been cool.
Got to play a game of Ghost Fighting Treasure Hunters with my youngest daughter.
Oh, tell me about that, Doug.
And that's
co-op or competitive?
It's a cooperative game. Yeah. You are trying to get, I believe, 8 gems out of the mansion before you're overrun with ghosts. And the ghosts, if you have to, they're little cute rubber ghosts. You put them in the room. If you have to put 3 in a room, that room becomes haunted, and it's kind of a bigger bad that you need to try and get rid of. And what I really like about it is it's got some difficulty adjustments and things that you can ramp up to make it a little bit more difficult, and different modules. So even though I'm playing it with a 6-year-old, I feel confident I could play it with my 12-year-old and ramp up the difficulty in the gameplay to work at her level too. So
interesting.
It's something that I want to put on the docket to play and see, because I definitely think it's one I've had for a while, but I think it is one that is probably a good game of the week candidate, and certainly a Kinderspiel des Jahres, so it's got some pedigree behind it.
Yeah, in recognition for sure. It's interesting to watch you go through those kids' games now with your youngest, and then at the same time go through the process of ruling in and ruling out for the podcast. It's been it's been interesting to watch you go through that. That's cool.
Well, and it's weird going through when you've got a 6-year-old, and then on the other end of the spectrum, you have one that's just getting into gaming and is, you know, you're
very enthusiastic about it though too.
Yes,
runs to the table.
Yeah, she's excited about it, and teaching her basic things and some of the stuff that we'll talk about later of patience and self-control and things like that. And then on the other end of the spectrum, you have the eldest who's almost getting to the point of no game is really off limits, you know, and feeling comfortable that, oh yeah, she can handle that. And to be on both ends of that spectrum is really bizarre.
Oh, that's awesome. Yeah. I've got a couple other things. I'm going to pivot here a little bit, if that's all right. Just looking at my notes, I had, I've gone from buying whatever I could get my hands on to try before buy. And with convention season upon us, just wanted to share some good news. Many games are going to get played once and then we'll get traded. So I think I covered that. But then two, last week we covered Cargo Noir as our game of the week.
Yeah.
And Serge Leggett, rest in peace, Serge. Thank you for your contributions to the world. Was messing with my head a little bit because I've played some of his older games, but Nidavellir is a game that has been sitting on my shelf. And Doug likes to make fun of my game shelves, but I have a game shelf that is in and out. And so, folks, when 2024 concludes, if I haven't played these games, I have to get rid of them, you know? And so I've been looking at Nidavellir right over there, Doug, and its expansion, Thingavellir. And I thought, I wonder if that's in Board Game Arena. And I've read the rules 2 or 3 times, right? So last night, jumped on Board Game Arena while I'm watching the Cubs, got through the tutorial. Doug, not only did I play one live game, I played 4. I jumped in and just had a blast. And I thought, there is something to seeing how designers design and how they grow over time, but then also just to discovering a game. And so I don't know. I just wanted to share that there's I love how he does the building of sets to get other combinations and almost rewards, right? Like in Cargo and Noir, you're trying to get the yacht, you're trying to get this, you're trying to get that, you're building things. And I also love what he does with currency. So that was just cool. And I shared a moment last night. My 14-year-old stays up late at night, right? And so she's kind of like, Dad, what are you still doing up? Oh, I got this game played. I didn't even have to drag you or your mom or Doug. I did it all by myself, and I didn't even solo it either. So that is a nice thing with Board Game Arena, you know, trying a game that I already own and not having to guilt others into making time for it. But so that was awesome.
Yeah, it is interesting to see the designers and kind of their imprints on things, and you can play a game and maybe the theme is different. And I think of like Phil Walker Harding and Bruno Catala and some of them that you're like, oh yeah, that's definitely something that they would do or that they tend to put into games. You're right. It is cool to see not only when they're growing and new things, but then there's those subtle nods and Easter eggs of like, yeah, that's kind of like that other game that they did. And not in a bad way where they're copying themselves. Reiner has that too, where you're like, oh, of course it's got this type of scoring or whatever in it. But their fingerprints are all over it.
I had to laugh. I got on the BGG forums last night, and the latest forum for Nidavellir was, are you sure this isn't a Kanizzi design? What would Reiner have done? Go. And the comments immediately were second place wins. And it was just one homage after another. But it was a cool little game. And then I just wanted to add to the list of like to play this at a convention, like to play it with other friends, like to play it with you. There are just so many great games to explore out there. This one's from 2020. You know, it's not exactly the hotness either. But wanted to pass that along.
All right. Well, finishing up on not finishing up. There's a long way to go before we finish up. But what's on my shelf is not going to be ending anytime soon. But this week will be kind of quick because this is the Buffalo Game Shelf.
Oh,
so a lot of these we have
shelf.
Covered. The first one is Summer Camp, which we talked about in episode 31, followed up by Starry Night Sky, which is episode 139. Penny Black, 134, and Planted, 78. So if you want to learn more about those games, I encourage you to go back and listen to those episodes, and you'll get a much better description than what I could certainly give you in a What's Awesome in Gaming segment. But my last one that's on the shelf, the outlier, because it fills the space that's left, is Quarriers. And Quarriers is a game that was designed by Mike Elliott and Eric Lang, one of their earlier designs, and it eventually kind of evolved into what became Dice Masters, which was a short-lived collectible dice game. But in Quarriors, you're rolling dice, you're kind of building there's a deck-building element to it of acquiring these monsters, acquiring their dice, getting them out and rolling them. And what I like about it is it does something with the it has a very much a trading card game type of feel or a deck building game feel, but it works really well with more than two players. So like when you play a deck building game like Star Realms or something like that, and it just feels like, yeah, this is really good at two players. Even Lorcana, when you start adding more, it's like, who do I attack? Who do I do that? And it's just like you feel like you're king making and stuff like that. And the way that Quarriors does it is you put your fighters out there, and if they are still in your battle area by the time it gets back to your turn, you can score points for them. And so I like that because it's clear to everybody who's scoring and when, and trying to eliminate those heroes. And then it does something really cool, which is if you want to score that hero, you then lose that hero as well. So there's that kind of divide of like, do I want to keep this guy up here for defense? Do I actually want to score it now? So it's got some cool things going on in it.
Yeah, the timing of when to let go, but you're going to have to let go of that person. Is it to defend or is it to score, right?
Yeah, and in order to win, you're going to have to lose them and build back up again. So there's no I've got this huge, awesome army, and then I'm indestructible. So it's a really cool game, and I've got several of the expansions that all kind of fit into one box. So that's why it fills that last little spot. Anything else you want to talk about, Michael? Any games?
That's great. What a nice little treat. We played that about 3 years ago now, Doug. Hard to believe. We should get that back to the table again.
Yeah.
With more than just you and me. I'd like to see that at three or four players.
Yeah.
I've followed up on my followed up. I've shared a lot of things that are awesome. I believe we're in episode 166, so I'll get back to my run sheet here, and let's get into our game of the week.
All right. Well, if you want to interact with us and other like-minded individuals, head over to the Discord server. It's a great community over there, gameschooler.com/Discord. If you're interested in learning more about it and where to sign up and things like that, spread the word about the podcast if you haven't already. Yes, Michael.
Just to jump in on our Discord, I love when our Discord folks, not our, but the Game Schooler podcast Discord folks are, I guess, go to a convention. I have a whole list of regional conventions all over the country. We have... it's mostly United States folks that are on our Discord, but there's just a lot of great things happening, and they're even kicking off games on Board Game Arena, and it's been cool to get to know people.
Yeah, no, great call there. Spread the word about the podcast if you like what we're doing, and if you have any questions or comments, feel free to reach out to us at email@gameschooler.com. Again, email@gameschooler.com. We'd love to interact with you and hear what kind of questions, feedback, things like that. With that out of the way, let's head over to the games of the week.
The games of the week. The game of the week is an in-depth look at a family-friendly game we think you should try if you get the chance. This week, we are covering Namiji and Takedo. Doug, give us the stats.
All right. Well, first of all, why are we covering both of these games at the same time? Is that they are very similar with some slight differences, which we will talk about through the explanation. Both games are designed by Antoine Bauza, and both have art by Javier G. Durin. I apologize. Illustrations by, did I not copy that over properly? Now I got to look in Board Game Geek.
N-A-I-A-D-E.
Yeah, I'm way off.
Naida,
yeah. Okay, so apologies there. Both games are published by Funforge, and Takedo came out in 2012. Namiji came out in 2022. Both of them are 2 to 5 players. Both of them take about 45 minutes. Both of them have a 8+ score on from the publisher and the designer, or from Board Game Geek. I'm going to probably push that up to a 9 or 10.
Yeah.
To kind of really get the value out of it,
especially for Namiji, right?
Oh, for sure. Yeah.
Yeah.
And the irony is that I looked at the board game. This is going to classify as a family game for us. But I looked at the Board Game Geek weight rating, and both of them were at one was at a 1.74 and one was at a 1.76. So it was remarkable how down the line these games are rated for the amount of different votes and stuff that are coming in, right?
Yeah.
So what are you doing in these games? Both of these games have a mechanism in which you are... in Takedo, you're going on a kind of a vacation, zen journey across Japan. And Namiji is the same thing, except you're going in a circle of kind of visiting different ports throughout Japan.
Filling up your boat.
But there is a linear track, whether it's a straight line in Takedo or a circle in Namiji, in which you go forward and you never come back. And the person that is furthest behind gets to take the next action and can go as far forward as they would like outside of a couple of stopping points throughout the game where everybody has to stop. So I can go 5 spaces against the person all the way in front, ahead of them, but then that's going to give other players chances to make more stops in between until I eventually get a turn again. And a lot of times people will kind of refer to that as a Tokaido mechanism when you're describing that as a game. When you are moving along the board in Tokaido, there are several places that you can stop at. And what I like about this game is that there are five or six different location types, and they all function the same way. So as the game goes along, you don't have to remember, oh, what does this space do? What do I get when I get here? So they all kind of work together in that way. The first place that you can go to is a village, and the village gives you souvenirs. As you collect unique souvenirs, you score more and more points for each souvenir. So the first one you get is worth 1 point. The second one is going to be worth 3 points if it's different than the first one. So you're basically doing some kind of set collection with the village spaces. The next type of place you can go to is a farm, which you just collect money. You collect 3 coins, which you can use to buy souvenirs and buy meals, things like that throughout the course of the game. There are 3 different panorama spaces. When you land on these spaces, you are basically painting different panorama portraits. One of them is 3 cards long, one of them is 4 cards long, and the other one is 5 cards long. And so if you happen to land on the mountain one, you are going to grab the first painting of the mountain painting, the first card of that painting. And then if you land on another one, you're going to get the second one. So depending on how many you get, the more points you're going to score, and those increase in points as they go up. There's also a bonus for the first person that completes each of those panorama paintings. So there's extra bonus points awarded for that. There are also hot spring spaces. Those are just straight victory point cards that you collect when you go there. There is a temple in which you can donate 1, 2, or 3 coins to the temple to earn 1, 2, or 3 points. But there's also a bonus at the end of the game for whoever has donated the most coins to the temple. And there's a reward for second place, things like that. You can also have encounters, and those are going to be basically little special ability cards that you can get, the one-time use. It might give you a free souvenir. It might give you 3 coins. It's kind of a wild card. It might just give you 3 victory points. And then the last place is you're arriving at inns. And at every inn, you have to stop. There's 2 or 3 of, I think there's 3 of them maybe on the board. And then when you stop there, if you are the first person there, you get to draw the number of cards per the number of players, plus 1. So if there's a 3-player game, I'm going to draw 4 cards. And then I get a chance to buy a meal first. And there's each meal is worth 6 points, but the cost of them varies from 1 to 3 coins. And so being into the inn first gives you that first look to be able to buy something cheap. But the other thing is that throughout the game, you cannot have the same meal twice. So if you're the last one in and it's the second or third inn that you've been to, you may have no choice but to not get anything because the one that's left is either too expensive or it's a meal that you've already eaten. So you go through that just kind of collecting points as you go. At the end of the game, once everybody's reached the end of the track, you're going to score. I said there's the bonus points for finishing the panoramas. If you have the highest sum of coins on your meal cards, you can get the gourmet bonus. If you have if you've visited the most hot spring areas at the end of the game, you get a bonus for that. If you get the most encounter cards, you can get a bonus. And depending on who collected the most souvenirs, also gets a bonus. You can play with traveler cards that kind of give you an extra bonus or ability while you go. So that's the basics for Tokaido. Now, what's different about Nemiji is it also has panorama cards, so it has that whole mechanism in there as well. It has what they call a whirlpool station, which acts similar to the temple in Tokaido, except you're starting out with a negative 15 points, and every time you drop off one of your tokens, you start with 4 whirlpool offering tokens. Every time you get rid of them, it decreases that negative point penalty. So it works kind of similar to the temple. as you go along. There's the panoramas. There is a sacred rock, which those are secret objective cards. So you can collect those, and if you complete them at the end of the game, that's how you can get some points from then. At the dock, which are similar to the inns, you are getting either meals or special abilities that will last for the rest of the game. But it works in the same way as far as drafting cards and things like that.
And you can't duplicate, same way.
Correct, yep. And the biggest difference has to do with your net on your boat and kind of collecting fish. There's two ways that you can do that. There's an angling station, which in the middle of the board, there's a big pile of face-down fish tokens.
So let's just pause.
Yeah.
I mean, that's the biggest difference between Takedo and Namiji. Namiji re-implemented Takedo. In Namiji, you have a boat with 12 spaces. And I'm going to send it back to you so you can tell folks about what the goal is of your boat with 12 spaces with your net.
Yeah. So in the middle of the board, there's a huge pile of face-down fish tokens. And when you get to an angling station, which is one of the stops that you can go to, you pick one and you can add it to your boat. And then you have to flip over more for the next players that come along. They come in three different colors, the fish do, and maybe four different types, something along those. I may have those numbers way off. Essentially, in your grid of 12 spaces, you are trying to get rows and columns that are either all of the same fish type or all of the same color. And if you do, you get different bonuses across the grid, depending on which column you fill up. There's also net casting stations that you can go to, which kind of give you two fish at once. And it's a card and it'll fill up two spaces on your boat. And the last part, which I think is one of Michael's favorite parts, is a crustacean trap station.
You betcha.
And this, you draw a random token out of the bag, and you can draw up to five. But if you ever draw a second crab, you bust. But every token that you pull out up until then is worth a victory point. So you keep pulling out tokens and then decide when to stop. Those are the biggest differences. It has to do with that little player board of your boat that you're filling in with fish. But functionally, the mechanisms and the way that you're going around the table is the same.
Well, and it's a beautiful, clean game.
Yeah.
Namiji, just like Takedo, just very elegant and smooth. I get the feeling that this is imaginary, folks. All right. I know we create board game content, and some would consider us media reviewers. I wouldn't consider us either one of those, but in my imagination, not Doug's, Antoine Bauza gets done playing Quacks of Quedlinburg, where he's pushing his luck from pulling chips out of a bag and says, I can do better. And he incorporates the crustacean station into Namiji with fishing and the boat and the tiles and the set collection. Both games are excellent. Both games are great. But for me, my collection personally, I love what the boat adds and that push your luck, a little bit of spice with Namiji. But that's just me.
Yeah, I mean, both of them have what I would call a zen-like playing experience. You just kind of meander along and there's no... I mean, yeah, the push your luck stuff on Namiji could be considered, but there's no real negative actions to the game.
Everything's good.
You know, it doesn't matter. It's like, and it works so well because it's relaxing, yet at the same time, the interaction and the tension of I hope Michael doesn't take the spot that I want to go to next. But then it becomes one of those things where, shoot, he took that. I'm going to go to this space and I'm going to get some stuff anyway. And it's kind of cool, you know.
It keeps it moving, right?
Yeah.
The game doesn't stall. I guess I cannot say that. I haven't played with severe AP folks, but Doug had a very lengthy description there, folks. And because he was unpacking two games, keep in mind, both games are under a 2.0 complexity on Board Game Geek, which we haven't, don't dive into as regularly as we used to, but what we're saying, they're both family games.
Yeah.
There's five or six different types of locations. That's no different than five or six different types of, you know, sushi or, you know,
symbols, cards, that type of thing.
Yeah. And so once you get those down, there's you're into the game, you're up and running. And what I like about Takedo is that long linear board. The first time you see it on a table, it's like, there's no way we're going to get this done in 30 minutes. But because, you know, you're probably only, if in a three-player game, you're going to cover 30% of the stops, right?
Yeah.
Maybe 40%. The game just moves. And every turn, I'm watching what everybody else at the table is doing because I'm invested in what I can get to and can't get to.
Yeah. The artwork in this is awesome. It just does such a good job of being clean and easy to read and follow. And even in the Namiji, they do a great job with the colorblind thing with
symbols are fantastic.
And the way that works out. I love the simplicity of Takedo with the wrinkles of Namiji. And I think what that does is that it creates an opportunity of two very similar games for slightly different audiences, right?
Yeah.
So Takedo is a great entry-level family game, and so is Namiji. Like, playing Namiji right out of the box is not going to be overwhelming to a family either, but it does add a couple more of those gamer wrinkles that I think if you play a lot of games, you may gravitate more towards Namiji than possibly Takedo. That being said, both of them are still in my collection. I have both of them, and I like them both for very different reasons, even though they share the exact same mechanisms of how the game functions.
Yeah, and we have another friend who we've played games with, and the first time I played Namiji and the first time he played Namiji, we had a very similar reaction of, yeah, I got to go get that. I need that game at my house. You know, and I think that is... that says a lot about the Takedo and Namiji. They are, Antoine Bauza is a prolific designer, you know, Seven Wonders. And both of these games kind of fit in that of the first time you get a chance to try it, you'll know right away if it's a hit for you or anyone else in your family. They just, they scratch that gamer itch. I was searching for something that wasn't so cliche, Doug.
Yeah, it's impossible.
It is. It's not impossible. I just have to search harder. I'll send it back to you while I search. They're good games.
Yeah, I think if you're playing with experienced gamers, I'd jump straight to Namiji. If you're talking about skills, the competition, this is a great young gamer, early competition teacher, I think. This does a great job of teaching younger gamers competition in a way that I think is healthy and graduated steps up, which is anytime I played with my kids and younger gamers, there's that thing of like, that's the space I want to go to, and tears when it doesn't happen.
Yeah.
And this one,
there's still cool spaces to go to.
Yeah. And it's still happen. It's constantly happening. You're constantly going to get blocked out of the spaces, but it's in a non-threatening, it's a non-take that way. It's like, well, you know, your sister just went to that space, so it's not there for you anymore. And so I think that is one of the things I really like about that, is a good way to teach. You can't always get what you want in a game that keeps the flow going.
Yeah, and the other thing that I just, from a family game perspective, want to jump in on, because I don't want to do the comparison game and compare this to Seven Wonders or Antoine Bauza's other games, but this is a game that is very balanced, where the first time somebody plays, they're likely not going to get blown out by 35 points. It's still going to be a close game. You're going to collect some sets. You're going to get points for some of the things you do, and you're probably not going to get to maximize everything that you want to do. And that scoring at the end is fun. It really is fun to kind of see, oh, where did you get your bonuses? Where are you getting points for in this? Where are you getting points for in that? And I really like that about the Takedo Namiji, that I feel like kids have a chance. and are in it. And even Takeaway Kids, new gamers. If yeah. you're bringing somebody into your game group and you're kind of filling that backlog of games to try, the Takedo Namiji is a good game to get to the table, because there's a lot of insecurity that can come when people are joining a game group, right? I'm not as much this. I'm not as much that. I don't speak the shorthand this. I don't have the experiences or inside jokes of that. And I yeah. think the Takedo Namiji is a good little game to get people in, up, running, engaged. Let's have fun.
Yeah. The other thing is, it's a good game that teaches observation in a way that's manageable. So in Tokaido, without that extra player board, it's everybody's focus is on the board the entire time. So it's easy to see what other people are kind of going after, what they're chasing after, and to kind of go from there is a really cool skill. I think these games are really good at developing some of those early gamer skills in a way that's approachable.
Yeah, and at the same time, you have to be tactical. You have to yeah. be able to just be on your feet and move. And from that, this might not be the best game to play with somebody who is hyper-competitive. Or if they are hyper-competitive, just let them know to dial it down a little bit. I fall into that. I can be kind of a meanie head if I'm not careful, because you're not going to get your way every time. The game is designed yeah. for you to have to make choices that might not be the most optimal right now, but in two or three moves could pay off for you.
Yeah. All right. Anything else on this one, Michael?
Yeah, one thing I want to address, because both versions have like super deluxified. And mm-hmm. I know when I was on the search for Namiji, I wanted to get the deluxe. I wanted to get the deluxe. And I picked up the base game in a trade and admittedly was a little disappointed because I didn't get my deluxe. But when I got it, I was really impressed.
Yeah.
It's like, yeah, you know, if I play this game five or six times over the next 5 or 6 years, let's be honest here, these cardboard tokens and the few wooden pieces are still really nice. So I did want to address that, because in doing research for this episode, for both versions, especially Takedo, there's like an ultra deluxe version that $250. And I just... hey, if that's what you want to do, good for you. But I know, as somebody who wanted the deluxe version, who now has the base, I'm very happy with the base version. So yeah. maybe that's just me, but maybe you have some thoughts to add to that. I know that this is a game where there are tiers.
Yeah, there's a lot of different variations out there of as the years have gone on, where it's expansions, collector's editions, 10th anniversary editions. There's a lot out there. I don't think you can go wrong with the base. And I think part of that is the artwork.
Yeah,
you know, the artwork just does such a good job of making it feel deluxe, even though it doesn't really matter if you don't have the metal coins or some of the other upgrades that might be in the games. I've never had an issue with that.
Yeah, somebody who shows up and makes sushi for you at your table while you're playing. If that happens, I'd buy that version, Doug. But yeah. till then, yeah.
$40,000.
Okay, for a private chef. I'll hold off. I'll hold off at this moment.
All right. Well, that is our game/games of the week. Now let's move on to the School of Gaming.
The School of Gaming. In the School of Gaming, we discuss concepts, keywords, etiquette, and helpful ideas in the world of gaming. This week, we're going to discuss logic and self-control for younger gamers. Doug, did you want to lead us into this segment?
Yeah, well, this comes from one of our listeners who's asking about games that might work for teaching some of these things. They had a child that was more interested in a lot of the narrative games and found that they didn't get a lot of the other skills. And I kind of have two different avenues for this, depending on each category there. The first one being the logic portion. And I think the listener's age, I think, was 10 years old.
Okay.
And I think one of the biggest areas to kind of improve logic is those deduction games. And because they do such a good job of if this, then that type of scenarios. And a game like Outfoxed, especially where it's a cooperative deductive game, and you know, the older your kid gets, you know, which the 10 is probably the top end of that, but it allows them to follow through on some of that logic. You can take a step back and let them kind of lead the horse and come to some of those conclusions. What do you think about that?
No, I like that. I like that on the logic. Yep. Keep going.
As far as, and geez, I mean, I would also assume that a lot of the abstract games or things like that, where you're not getting bogged down by theme or, you know, that narrative stuff is not getting in the way. I think that those would also be another set of games to look at. Some of that logic.
Can I jump into the self-control, or did you want to go on that?
Yep, nope, I've got some stuff on there too, but go ahead.
Yeah, the thing that's burning that I can't get out of my mind that I feel like I need to say right now, or I might just have to walk out of the studio, is simultaneous play works for both. So yeah. if logic and self-control, if you have games that allow players to be taking their turns at the same time, and then there's almost that reveal, that can be really good. And I, in the last segment, I talked about Sushi, but Sushi Go, you know, where there's that simultaneous play of drafting. We're all selecting a card. We're all passing the card. We're all revealing the card. There's a little bit of fun that is allowed to happen in between moments in that game, that sense of simultaneous play it unfolds, and then the logic is in there as well as you're trying to collect sets and work together. So I think games that have the simultaneous play, you know, we've talked about some of Emerson Matsuchi's games and Phil Walker Harding's games in the past, just seem to work really well for my kiddos and other people's kiddos that I've played games with.
But, well, so I feel like the simultaneous play is a situation of covering up a lack of self-control or patience, not necessarily teaching those things, right?
Yeah, so like, but I can't teach a 10-year-old to be a 35-year-old. I've got to embrace the 10-year-old with where they're at, and I don't...
No, go ahead. Sorry.
Yeah, if the priority is we want to play games, we want to get together and play games, I may have to look at some of those games. One example that just... it screams at me, and I had this as a counterexample, but I wasn't sure I wanted to go there, is Ticket to Ride. Ticket to Ride works very well with my 8-year-old. I think it could work well with my 14-year-old now, but at one point in time, my oldest just, there wasn't enough happening in the game.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
No, I agree with that. I think, and it kind of leads into where I'm heading with it, which is I took the idea of, how do I improve that skill? How do I improve the skill
of logic? So the skill's lagging and you want to improve it.
Correct. And I think there is a huge component of meet your kid where they're at, you know, right? There's that level of they're not really good at this. I don't want to not play any games. And I think the simultaneous play is great for those type of things. If you want to increase the self-control, the patience, that type of thing, is certainly any game where players have to take turns is going to help them with that. However, the caveat is what you mentioned in Ticket to Ride is that theme is a huge factor in this.
Yeah.
You need to find a game that they're interested in order to make it easier for them to sit through longer durations than they may be used to. And it doesn't matter, like, you're not going to improve a kid's self-control by giving them a game that they're not interested in that has long turns and gaps in between, because they're never going to magically engage, right?
Sure.
So you need to have the game that they're interested in that makes it worth wanting to wait a little bit longer than they're used to. And one of the games, go ahead.
No, that's a good point. Keep going.
I was going to say one of the games that you may not think of, but I think does a really good job of teaching this skill, is a real-time game, and that's 5-Minute Mystery.
Yeah.
Because being the one to give the clues and hold the gadget is so appealing and alluring to the kids at the table that they want to be doing that. But they have to wait. And they can't wait to get their hands on it. But because of the way that the game works, they don't have a choice but to wait. Else they're never going to get their turn by helping everybody else through the puzzle and then passing that device on. And so it seems kind of counterintuitive that a real-time game could work in that way. I have found in my experience of playing that game that my kids are so excited to be the clue giver that they're willing to wait. And they're
It's the structure of the turn.
Yeah.
Right? It's like, it's going to be my turn. It's going to be my turn. Okay, it is my turn.
Yeah.
And then the time is a real factor there because there's a running clock that's also part of that turn structure. That's good.
Yeah.
Yeah. I just had two other suggestions.
Sure.
And I don't want to hijack the segment, so jump in and interrupt. But the one is there something else that the younger gamer can be doing to allow them to develop the logic? And my example is keeping score. And bad example, but I can remember playing Yahtzee in a classroom when I was 12 years old when we had a substitute teacher, right? I can also remember during the lockdown, during COVID times, playing Yahtzee as a family. And I am able to tick off my combos, right? And for a 10, 11-year-old, I'm not having to look up and have somebody else keep score for me. I'm keeping score by myself. And the other area where I've had very good luck is with some flipping rights or rolling rights.
Yeah.
Because you're keeping score, but you are making the connections physically. I have a pen or pencil. I have dice in my hand or a card is getting flipped. And there's something very tactile about I'm scratching off either a path or a route. We've talked about Scribbly Gum as a game of the week. We've also talked on and off about a game called Welcome To, where you are building out your neighborhood. So I think those are two other examples where, you know, that logic and that pacing really helps for some of those younger gamers.
Yeah, well, the logic in those rolling rights is awesome. That's a great suggestion because in most of them, you're in charge of where you want it to go.
Yeah.
You know, whether it's Scribbly Gum in the path or where you want to put the number on in the house and Welcome To, there's that agency, but that agency also lends itself to picking your own path. And in order to pick your own path, you have to know when and why you should be doing something.
Yeah.
And getting that real-time result afterwards from that.
Nice little segment, Doug. I didn't know where we were going. I never would have thought about real-time. I'm glad you brought that in with 5-Minute Mystery. I think that is clever. And I think there's a lot of different ways. The other thing, though, and not a shameless plug because we don't profiteer off this, at least not yet, but our website, Doug's done a fantastic job with games of the week that we've talked about. And if you stumble through a few different games that we've talked about, you know, whether it's 5-Minute Mystery or some of the others, I don't want to call them out in case you haven't created a page for it. But there's great little guides, and you'll get a sense of, I've played this, so now I'm wondering about that. And if it's on our website, it'll be readily available at a friend's house, a local store, someplace where you can hopefully try it if you get the chance.
Yep. No, that's awesome. Love to hear what people on the Discord server think about that. If you have any comments directly related to this, again, email at gameschooler.com and let us know. But we are going to move on to the high five. If you're anything like us, you're constantly on the hunt for new games to check out. This week, we're going to be doing that old The Book Was Better.
Yes, The Book was better than the movie, and let me tell you why. I spent 45 days to read the book. You spent an hour and 45 minutes to watch the movie.
So this is going to be the original is better. A lot of games sometimes get new artwork, complete second editions, reprints, things like that. And this week we're going to highlight games that we think maybe the original was better. Was this a hard list for you to make, Michael?
You know, it wasn't because it's so subjective. Who's going to argue with my list? I could pick five. But what it was, Doug, it was a very clear list. And so, and I don't think any of these are going to surprise you because in our 5 years that we've kind of been playing board games together, we've had this conversation. But I think with our audience, it will surprise folks. And I think the order that the games come out could also be surprising.
Sure.
I do have some at my reach. How about you? Was it a hard list?
It was one where some of them came to me immediately. And once I got to five, I was like, yep, that's it. And I didn't look further than that.
Yeah.
And almost all of them were from memory. I didn't, a lot of times I'll do some research on Board Game Geek or look through my collection. And this was one where I was like, yeah. And once I had five, I stopped. So no honorable mentions for me this week.
Yeah, same here. And it was one where I looked at, there were actually some games that I've gotten rid of. And I'll talk about that when I get to them because I like the original better. And I only need one. I don't need four. And speaking of, I'll just jump right in. Number five for me is Schattentaten from Reiner Knizia, 1999. It was re-implemented by Battleline in 2000, Los Banditos in 2008, and Knights Poker in 2019. And some people prefer Battleline. I prefer just the good old 1999 Schattentaten, where, and we've talked about this game, but it's a two-player only game where you are competing over these little tiles and you're playing sets out. And this is not my original thought. I'm stealing this from my friend Doug. But one of the things that's really satisfying and fun about that game is you can, through deduction and logic, tell somebody that, no, there's no way you can mathematically beat me there. So I get that point.
Yeah.
And then I think it's three in a row or four anywhere on the board and you win. A game that my wife and I really enjoy playing. I enjoy playing against you. I have another buddy that I enjoy playing against. I have another family member. So over time, I have four or five different people that little Schattentaten comes out and have a lot of fun playing it. And for whatever reason, I think it's just the order that I played Schattentaten before I played Battleline. Doug, they're the same game, but Battleline doesn't appeal to me. And so maybe it's just me, but I like the silliness of Schattentaten.
Well, mine would be almost the reverse because I was introduced to Battleline first and then Schattentaten completely replaced it. But what's interesting is the story of that game is that Schattentaten came out and then Battleline came out and added these kind of extra abilities and powers that then they incorporated into the next version of Schattentaten. So there's a kind of a weirdness, I guess, with all of Dr. Knizia's games where it's like the alpha and the omega. When did one start and when did the other one begin?
Well, and he's in his fifth decade of designing games.
Yeah.
You know, so even just keeping all of that straight can really take a lot. So that's number five for me. What's number five all for you, Doug?
My number five is Libertalia. And this originally came out in 2012, and there's a reprint in 2022 by Stonemaier Games. The original is by Marabunta, and the designer is Paolo Mori. And this one kind of comes down to, although I think they streamlined a couple of things, the artwork in the original one, which is very much inspired by the Pirates of the Caribbean Disney movie series, just gets me into the theme way more. It is a very mean and cutthroat game. And if I want to be playing a mean and cutthroat game, I want it to be real pirates, human pirates.
And animal pirates.
Yeah, and that's what the Stonemaier one did. The components in the Stonemaier one are better. I think they really potentially improved the game, but the thematic connection just really took it out of it for me when I played the new version, and that's why the original is still on top for me. That is Libertalia, my number five.
Yeah, great pull. And some of it is just the essence of the game and the timing of the game. And I think that's a coming out around the Pirates of the Caribbean, that matters, right?
Yeah.
All right, Doug, number four for me is incredibly nitpicky, but it is my list, and that is I prefer the first edition of Sheriff of Nottingham from Arcane Wonders. And the art, similar to what you just talked about in Libertalia, but the art is just slightly more diabolical. The gameplay just pops a little bit more sinister with some of the cards. And this is one that it might not be controversial in some gamer circles, but I like the felt bags. And I think some of it has to do with that's the version that I played the first time. So sure. Not, they're virtually the same game, right? Because I played the second edition at a convention, but they out of a game library, but they are basically the exact same game, right?
Yeah.
Just different art.
Yeah. I'm not aware of anything that they did differently.
So that might be a stretch for me, but that's the one that I own, and I like the Arcane Wonders version over the cool mini or not version.
Okay. There probably is a theme to mine, which is has a lot to do with art and presentation. And sometimes the people complain about the art, and then they put out a new version, and a lot of times the artwork is better in the new version. Sometimes, though, when there's a game that's kind of out of print and then it gets reprinted, and then they think there's two different things. One where the artwork is not great from the beginning and they improve it, right? And then the other one is when it's a game that's out of print and then they say, all right, well, now we're going to upgrade the art because we're putting out a new edition. And that's where this one falls into for me, and that the new art didn't work for me as well. And I think a lot of people, and that's Colosseum. Colosseum was originally published in 2007 by Days of Wonder. The designers are Wolfgang Kramer and Marcus Lupke. And they released one, Tasty Minstrel Games released one in 2017. And there's a new one coming out in 2024. So I'm interested to see how that one goes. But there was a charm in the original one.
Okay.
That was not replicated when they reprinted this in 2017. And I think everybody kind of missed that. It went from kind of having a fun cartoon family feel to being almost too gritty.
You're going to get eaten by a lion?
Yes. It's like it's almost the exact opposite of what Libertalia did, where it's like you took all of the cuddly fun parts off of this and then made it is like, this is too much. So I'm curious
to
see where
play this with my children.
Yeah, I'm curious to see where the new version comes in at, and whether that splits the difference or how.
Hopefully,
how
the new version has a simplified version that's stays true to the essence of Kramer and Kiesling, and it's not just modules and appendages put on it. But
yeah, well, it's kind of confusing because I think they're releasing two different versions. There's one that's just a straight up kind of reprint, and then one that's getting modules and inspired by the original. So we'll see.
Well, I'm hoping you keep us up to date on that, Doug, that I don't have to. Good.
Yeah. So that's my number four, Colosseum.
Awesome. If there's crossover on this next one, please jump in because I don't want to steal your thunder. I know I go first on this one, but I just want to be very clear that I love both versions of this next game. And some of it might be some recency bias, but that is Longshot, which was designed in 2009 by Chris Handy, and then re-implemented by Longshot the Dice Game, which I think is just a very different game. One is more of a roll and write. One is more of a roll and move and bet and gamble.
Yeah.
But having played the 2009 version recently with Doug and his brother at a game day, boy, I could see the appeal in that game.
Yeah.
It takes a little bit longer to explain and set up. There's some paper money that's involved, but man, I just had a blast with it, and they feel like two very separate games. And if you and I ever moved, if I lived in a different part of the country, I know that would be one game that I would be looking to add to my collection. Not easy to get. Right now, in a lot of ways, because of the things that we talked about with being out of print and things like that. But if you get a chance to play it at a convention, or if you have a friend who has it, put some positive peer pressure on them to get it off the shelf and give it a play. And again, I really enjoy Long Shot the Dice Game. And I played a lot, I introduced it to a lot of people, but that original from 2009 and Z-Man Games that Chris Handy put together, man, that's a cool racing game. To me, that's just a quintessential horse racing game.
Yeah, no, that's a good one. I didn't even think about it, but you're right. You're spot on that one. Good find for me in a math trade a long time ago.
Way to go, Doug.
Yeah. My number three was published originally in 1992 by Milton Bradley. And the designer is Masura Aki and Carol Wisely. And that is Looping Louie, or Lupin Louie. And the reason I have this on the list is that since then, they have released Lupin Chewy, and they now have the Bluey Keepy Uppy game. But the big difference between both of those versions and the original Lupin Louie is that Lupin Louie, in Lupin Louie, you have three chickens that you're protecting, and there is an airplane spinning around the board. It's motorized with a battery, and it goes up and down, and it's trying to knock your chickens, and you have this little lever that you press that shoots Louie up in the air and try and knock out the chickens on everybody else's farm. And what makes the original better is it's got four. It's for four players, where the new ones are both for three players, and it's just so much better to have more people on there. I don't know why. You know, if it's a cost thing or what, but just
it's
an awesome.
It's bigger, it's clumsier.
Yeah. So that's my number three, Lupin Louie.
I got to jump
the original,
in on that
go
one.
Get it.
Yeah, because Doug and our friend, we have two other friends that are aficionados on this, and I can't keep up. So I saw the Bluey one at Target. I think I'm in the conversation. And Doug just says to our buddy, no, it's Chewy, 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 it's Chewy, Chewy. And I had no idea what they were even talking about until this moment when Doug gets into the nuances and fully unpacks it. So yeah. You prefer the 1992 Lupin Louie version.
Correct. Yes.
Bigger, almost has like a Hungry Hungry Hippo vibe to it.
Okay. Not the Lupin Bluey or Lupin Chewy.
Now I could speak the shorthand on that. Good. We're up to number two. Number two for me is from our dear friend of the pod, not really, but making that up, maybe someday if we see him, Rüdiger Dorn's Las Vegas. I believe 2012. I don't have the notes in front of me. That's just off the dome. I'll look it up here when Doug looks it up. But the original does not have powers associated with the casino that the newest version does, Las Vegas Royale. And I know that we actually do have family members and things like that who come to us for game recommendations. And Las Vegas is one that people play at our house and then go out and get. And they always get that new one because it's readily available on Amazon. And I've had this happen twice with two different family members. They go to play it, 6 to 10 months later with other friends. And they're like, I don't remember these powers.
Yeah.
And so I always, I get that text or I get that call and just tell them, no, you don't have to play with it. You can just play without, just set the casinos out regular. So
yeah,
for me and my house, and again, I will play Royale all day long. That's cool. That's great. But I just prefer that having those casinos out, placing the dice on the casinos, that basic area control mechanism.
Yeah.
It works really well for me and my family. That's Las Vegas.
Well, and the fast setup time.
It's blazing fast.
Yeah, it makes a big difference. Michael actually has my original copy of
Thank you, Doug.
Of Las Vegas. I have the new one just because I wanted the option to add them in if I could. But I can 100% see the point. My number two is one that I actually haven't played the replacement for, but everything that I've read from it, I can tell that I prefer the original, and that is Bruges. So Bruges was am I stealing your thunder with one?
No. Keep going. I haven't played it either because I don't have the English cards. I have to wait for Gen Con to pick them up. Go
there's
ahead.
There's a couple of things that this does. And the original came out in 2013, and it was re-implemented as Hamburg in 2022. The original is by Z-Man Games, both games designed by Stefan Feld. And there are a couple of things where Hamburg does well, which is it adds some of the expansions and things like that. However, Bruges is very unfriendly. It's very colorblind unfriendly.
The unfriendliest.
And they improved that in Hamburg. But in a way, it makes it difficult for non-colorblind people to kind of match everything up from what I've seen on the board and what and the complaints that I've heard of, okay, you got to put these dice in a certain spot and things like that. But the big thing is that there are a bunch of cards in this game. It's the crux of the game. And each card has a different ability on it. And in the new version, they decided to make it language independent with no text. And
you're killing me, Queen Games. You're just sitting over there on my want to play shelf, Queen Games. Sorry, Doug, go. No.
And even in the game with text on the cards, after you get the cards, you need to look and say, okay, what does this card do? Read it over, look at it. Oh, okay. All right, got it.
Read it twice, right? Read it once to understand if it's a good card.
Yeah.
Read it a second time to understand how you're going to use it or not use it.
Yeah. And then, so now you take that game and then you make it all symbols, and then you only put one player aid in the box or a rule sheet that then everybody has to pass around. And I can't imagine it. Like the vitriol on Board Game Geek in the forums about that design choice.
It's earned.
Is pretty obnoxious, and I would say stay away from it if you don't like looking at car crashes. But you know, Bruges is one that will always stay in my collection. I was excited when they announced a new version of it. I'm like, oh, great! And I'm sticking with my original. And I think the pricing on the secondary market indicates that a lot of people are doing the same as well.
Yeah, that's a great choice. It could be a whole different segment, and not to jump in too much, but I have no fewer than 18 to 21 inquiries out on Board Game Geek where I sent messages to people who have the cards, the English text.
Yeah.
And almost to a person, they all replied, said, no, thank you. I won't trade or sell them to you. And then a lot of them did tell me where they ended up getting them. You know, I got mine at PAX Unplugged. I picked mine up at this show. I got mine at that trade show. So I will be making a beeline for the Queen Games booth on the Thursday of Gen Con and throw down $20 and snarl at them and hopefully get those cards so that I can play the version. Good one, Doug.
All right.
On to me for
number
one, and it's Biblios 2007.
Great choice.
The original. Do we have crossover here or can I just go full rant? Okay. So this is a game that I played the original version first, was really excited because we had a game of the week coming up, and I got so excited for it. I got two other versions of Biblios for the King and me, which when I got it out and played it, I was like, this doesn't have any of the appeal of the original 2007, and I was really hoping it would because it has kind of some cutesy cartoony art. And then Quill and Parchment is a Roll and Write version, which, hello, love me some Roll and Writes. So I'm thinking, well, that'll be, no, none of them replace the 2007 original version from Yellow with Boring Monks. I can't tell if he's bald or if that's just kind of the thing he's wearing on his head, but just the original version to me is the superior version. Again, this is opinion. But I think others tend to agree. When you look at the ratings on Board Game Geek of the original and then the most recently released For the King and Me from 2021. So that's my number one pick. And that's the one that stays in my collection. So that's where I kind of stand by my pick.
And both of them by the same publisher.
Same
and
publisher.
They tried
same
to do
designer.
It. And it was one that we talked about on the podcast. And it was one of those where we were talking about, if we were doing that episode now, we would probably only talk about Biblios and casually mention that the other one was available. But we were in the thing where we wanted to talk about games that were readily available all the time. And so.
Yeah, in one where in October of 2022, episode 92 is where we did that For the King and Me / Biblios. I really tried to give For the King and Me the old college try. Like, no, I'm going to try. I don't need to go out and get Biblios. And finally, it was like, dear Noble Knight, please take this game back that I got from you. Please give me that game over there. Take my money.
Yeah.
That's my number one.
All right, my number one is a similar thing with a lot of the games on my list, in which they came out with a second version which incorporated stuff on from the expansion that is almost deemed necessary by everybody that plays the game. That's just so good. So mechanically, they updated the game, but universally, the art and the presentation of the game gets panned by those that have played it, and that is Kingsburg is my number one. The 2007 original Fantasy Flight Games version of this game has a charm and wonder about it in the artwork and the presentation. And yes, the original expansion makes it, you know, adds a whole other level of awesomeness to that game that they incorporated with the new version that came out in 2017. But it lost all of its charm, and it just kind of disappeared as a result of it. And I, you know, it's a great dice, a unique way of using dice. You roll your dice, and then you're putting them out on advisors and kind of looking around to see what the other opponents have and where you can fit yours in and things like that. And so it's a unique way to use dice, original when it came out. But that original has so much charm. I think, did you search out the original one, Michael?
Yeah, I did. And it's funny because that was episode 93, right? Huh. So I'm playing both of those games for the first time.
Yeah.
Right in that end of 2021 into 2022, getting repeated plays, and had a chance to get the newer version more than once because it's always on sale.
Yeah.
And I just kept walking by it. And then I got Kingsburg in a trade on the same day. I got it in two trades. And so I actually have an extra copy of the original that I just want to give away to a friend at some point so they can experience the same thing that I experienced. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Because exactly what you're talking about. I completely concur. We have a lot of agreement for these games.
Yeah. All right. Well, let us know. Oh, go ahead.
Yeah, I was just going to say good job on the brainwash on there, Doug, because usually I'm an independent thinker and I see things differently, but a lot of overlap on these. So,
well, we've talked about them long enough off air. So, and some that completely, you know, you got some great ones on your list that I didn't even think about. So, awesome list. I'm looking forward to seeing if there's ones that our listeners are, you know, prefer the original better. Next week, we're going to flip it on its side. We're going to talk about the second editions being better, which ones they improved and we like more than the original. We're going to be talking about some tips for getting the most out of a convention. And we're going to be talking about Pirate's Cove as our game of the week.
Oh, I can't wait. Dearest listeners, though, I do have a call to action. Before next week, if you're one of our listeners who's listening in the first 3 days of this podcast, and if you are on Board Game Geek and could nominate us for best podcast, just to be nominated. Because if you're at this point in the episode and you're still listening and we're out there week after week, just go over there and give us a nomination. I certainly don't spend any of your hard-earned money. So if you already have the icon and you're already voting, we would really appreciate a nominee to be one of the top 10, and then nominate your others as well, favorite podcasts, because it matters. It helps to bring new listeners in, and it will help to keep us going. And ego-wise, it'll be a boost for Doug and I. I'm not kidding you, man. We're at 166. That will take us easily right up to episode 200 just getting a nomination.
If you want this episode, this podcast to survive,
no,
vote. All right, and subscribe if you haven't. If you are a weirdo that just keeps listening to this episode, our episodes week after week, but haven't subscribed, please do that, or follow us on Game Schooler, on Axe at Game Schooler U. Check out our YouTube channel, subscribe there as well. Every little bit helps. Join us on the Discord, gameschooler.com/Discord. Thank you so much for spending the last hour or so with us. We truly appreciate it.
Now get out there and keep gaming.